We shook hands. We stood there for a moment in silence, then he said with much embarrassment, "Strange. Who are you really? I have the oddest feeling. Just as if I should bow before you with outstretched arms, right down to the floor. Very strange." He looked at me inquiringly, "Why do I have this odd feeling?" I answered, "You were finance minister in the government of my father in Egypt," and smiled. Those around us laughed heartily. They thought I was joking. But Mr. Walt Klimke didn't laugh. He kept on looking at me in a quizzical, embarrassed way, and all throughout the convention, which lasted for several days, he always called me Queen. Again and again, as he looked at me so searchingly, he would mutter, "Strange. Very strange." And in all our meetings during the convention, we talked together like two old friends. Another event of about the same period in my life stands out very sharply in my memory. One autumn evening, I went to bed as usual. I was dreaming something quite inconsequential when all of a sudden I seemed to be surrounded by bright light. Then in my dream, an automobile came speeding up and stopped right in front of me. Two men, dressed in white and looking like doctors, got out. One of them stepped up to me, pulled a spoon-like instrument out of his pocket and used it to scoop my defective eye out of its socket. The other man pulled out a little file, opened it and took out a big, round white disc that looked like a pill. Holding the pill up close for me to see, he said, "Don't be afraid. I'm now going to insert this disc in your eye socket. 12 of these must be consumed and then you'll get your eye back. So don't be frightened at the idea that you will now apparently be blind in this eye." Then he inserted the pill in my empty eye socket, closed my eyelid and bandaged my right eye with a white cloth. I awoke early in the morning and wanted to get up. Then I noticed that I couldn't see a thing with my defective right eye. It was just as if a board had been placed in front of it. I ran to a mirror to look at my eye. With my other eye, which was still good, I could see that the pupil of my right eye had turned grey in colour and was completely opaque. I knew it was a cataract. For several years one had been developing slowly in my right eye, but its progress was slow and unnoticeable, and even yesterday I could still see pretty clearly. It was completely invisible from the outside. And yet, now in the space of only one night, the lens in my right eye had crystallized into a cataract. "Don't be afraid." My dream visitor's voice echoed in my memory. "No, I won't be afraid. I'll just have to begin again a series of pilgrimages from one professor to another, and sooner or later one of them will operate on my eye. Long ago I learned that it doesn't do any good to be afraid, but what is the meaning of these white pills? And what is meant by the idea that 12 of them are going to have to be used up in order for me to get my sight back again? How can that be?" I went to various famous professors. In their unanimous opinion, my right eye was operable immediately, but they all said there was a danger I would always have to wear dark glasses afterwards. This was because they were going to have to cut out a bit of the iris which would give the pupil the shape of a keyhole, and because I was already 35 years old, they thought my eye would not be able to stand the exposure to more light through the enlarged pupil. So they advised me to wait with the operation, and I followed their advice. I kept on working, but I couldn't get used to working with one blind eye. The cataract bothered me greatly. Summer came, and as usual we went to spend our holidays at our family villa on the lake. There I met a Catholic bishop who told me I should certainly go to Vienna and have my eye examined by a world-famous professor whom he personally knew. "He uses different techniques from other doctors," said the bishop. "Go to him and ask him for his advice. I am a servant of God, and perhaps God is giving you this advice through my mouth." By this time I had heard so much advice about my eye that I was nearly immune. But the bishop's words, "perhaps God is giving you this advice through my mouth," made a deep impression on me. When autumn came, my father accompanied me to the professor in Vienna. He recommended an immediate operation. "You should get this ugly, bothersome cataract out of your eye as fast as possible. Without any doubt, it's psychologically bad for you not to. Won't my eye suffer greatly from the fact that you're going to have to cut out a bit of the iris? I asked. He looked at me long and searchingly, then tested my reflexes and began to talk about my sculpturing work, asking all kinds of things that had no connection with my eye. Then he suddenly said, "I won't cut out any of the iris. You can be assured your eye won't be sensitive to light. In that case, let's get the operation over as fast as possible," I answered. A week later I was in the sanatorium, preparing for the operation which was to take place the following day. It was a glorious autumn evening, and before going to bed, I stepped over to the window to look out over the beautiful city below. As I drew the curtain to one side to look out of the window, I saw the great round white disc of the full moon climbing slowly into the sky to the east. Instantly I recognized the great white pill the doctor had given me in my dream. It was a full moon. The doctor had told me, 12 will have to be used up. With my heart pounding in excitement, I started counting the time that had elapsed since that odd dream. Sure enough, 12 full moons had gone since that time. I knew the operation would give me back the sight of my eye. The next morning I lay on the operating table, and in an amazingly short time the operation was over. A light flashed in my blinded eye, and a moment later I saw a hand in front of it. "What do you see?" I heard the professor ask. "Your blessed hand, professor," I answered, and a moment later both of my eyes were bandaged. As I was being wheeled out of the operating room, I heard doors opening and closing and the soft voice of my father, "How was it, Esther?" "Good, father," I answered, "I can see again. The eye operation brought me many very interesting experiences, the most revealing of which was learning something more about those vibrations we call light, namely, that these vibrations are only light for our eyes, and healthy eyes at that. In other respects, light is a tremendous force, big enough to kill a person, or even stronger beings. It all depends on the relationship between the skin sensitivity of a living creature and the intensity of the light." This is what happened. A few hours after the operation, the professor came in and said, "Don't be alarmed when I take off the bandage from your eye. I have to see how it reacts to the light of a burning candle." I thought, why should I be alarmed? The doctor took off the bandage and said, "Now please open your eye." I was expecting to see a burning candle when I opened my eye. Instead, I saw only darkness, but I felt a terrible blow on my newly operated eye. Jerking my head back, I closed my eye again. I couldn't understand what had happened. My doctor laughed reassuringly, "Didn't I tell you not to be alarmed? The retina of your eye is so sensitive right now that it doesn't pick up light rays as light, but reacts as if it were being hit a sharp blow. Just go on resting. I'll come back in a few hours to examine your eye again. So far everything's going just fine," he said and left. I remained alone in my darkness, with plenty of time to think, what is light? How is it the same light I perceive with my healthy eye as the flickering flame of a candle can cause me as much pain as if I were being hit by a fist? I didn't see any light at all, but I did feel the wallop so strong it knocked my head back. From this, I was forced to conclude that if there were beings whose skin had the same sensitivity to light as the retina of my freshly operated eye, they could be struck from a great distance, perhaps even killed, by turning the light of a searchlight on them. Conversely, it is certainly conceivable that there could be some kind of light, for simplicity's sake we can call it ultralight, that is so much stronger in its effect than the light we are accustomed to seeing with our human eyes, that, depending on the sensitivity of our skin, it could strike us down in the same way ordinary light would affect a being with a skin as sensitive as the retina of my freshly operated eye. I realize that everything is relative, a question of the relationship existing between an operating force and the resistance it meets. This fitted in with the realization that there can be infinitely varied kinds of life existing on the different planets and heavenly bodies throughout the universe. A creature similar to man living on Uranus or Neptune, because of the much greater distance between those planets and the Sun as compared to the distance between the Earth and the Sun, might conceivably have a skin as infinitely sensitive to light as my freshly operated eye, and if such a being on one of these distant planets were to see in sunlight in the same way we see here on Earth, his eyes would certainly have to be immeasurably more sensitive to light than ours are. But do we need to go so far away? The myriad creatures living in the depths of the ocean have such eyes and capabilities we cannot even begin to understand, because we simply couldn't begin to exist in such dense darkness. In this vein I went on meditating on the unlimited possibilities of worlds without end and of the different forms of life they can contain, and the more I thought on these things, the more my heart filled with deep humility in the face of the power of the eternal being we call God. This eye operation brought me another very interesting and valuable experience. Through it I learned that the eyes take in light not only for themselves but for the entire body, just as the lungs do with air and oxygen. Light is force. On the third day after my operation, the professor came in with the nurse, and said, "Now it's time for you to get up and come over and sit in this armchair. Just put on your slippers, and the nurse and I will help you." I was offended, "Doctor," I said, "I'm not sick. And lying in bed for 3 days certainly hasn't made me so weak I can't sit up and move about myself." "You don't need to help me, good," the doctor said, "go ahead and get up by yourself, if you can." I started to get out of bed. But I was in for a big surprise. My feet and legs were so weak, so powerless, that I would have sunk to the floor if strong hands had not seized me from both sides and held me up. My legs hung down like two limp rags and my back was just as limp and powerless. So, quite the opposite of what I expected, I was really glad for help in getting out of bed and over into the armchair. How was this? Then I heard the professor laugh. "You see, you couldn't get up alone? It's just because you were in complete darkness for 3 days. When a person is suddenly shut off from light, he loses strength so fast he soon can't stand up alone anymore. You'll shortly be able to open your eyes again, and when you do, you'll find your strength returning quickly." One of our greatest problems during the war was how to help blinded soldiers, not so much because of their mental condition, but because of the complete debility which always and unavoidably accompanied their sudden blindness. The human soul is so wonderfully fashioned that a person always finds ways and means to survive even such a tremendous catastrophe as sudden blindness, and he can even go on and discover new joys in life or new aspects of old pleasures. But our greatest problems arose from the fact that these poor young men weren't even able to stand on their own feet for a long time. It was not possible for us to give them back the blessing of light. But thank God for the elasticity and resiliency of the body. In time, a blind person's skin takes over the whole job of providing light throughout his body. The problem of blindness is always most acute right after it hits its victim, simply because of the weakness caused by the sudden absence of light. I was silent. Ever since my eye had become diseased, I had begun to understand the significance of blindness much, much better than one ever could when he has two healthy eyes. Now, through my own experience, I came to understand the biblical passage, "The light of the body is the eye. If then your eye is true, all your body will be full of light. But if your eye is evil, all your body will be dark. If then the light which is in you is dark, how dark it will be." Matthew 6:22-23. And my heart bled the more at the thought that mankind isn't even satisfied with the blindness which occurs in nature. Quite the contrary, he goes out himself to wage wars in which countless otherwise healthy people are blinded, maimed and crippled. When will humanity be mature enough to refuse to obey the tyranny of politicians who unconscionably sign declarations of war? 2 weeks later, the professor took me into a dark room to examine both my eyes. With a very strong lens before the eye he had operated on, I was able to read everything he put before me, even to the tiniest letters. Then, to my amazement, this dignified old professor jumped up, seized me with both hands and hoisted me high above his head. He was such a charming old fellow that I really couldn't understand what had got into him and why he was acting so strangely. As he gently set me back on the floor, his face was beaming as he said, "The technique I used on operating on your eye has so far only been used for children and young people up to the age of 20. Beyond that age, there's a danger of inflammation of the iris, leading to total loss of vision in the eye. As you may remember, in our first consultation, I observed you closely, noting your extraordinary vitality and resilience. Your reflexes, too, were quite good, and as I always do, I followed my intuition. With the courage of my convictions, I operated on you as if you were still a child. So now you know why I'm so happy. The operation was a complete success. Your tissues were still young enough to come through this difficult operation in splendid form. So now you can go home with two healthy eyes, and with my heartiest congratulations." I thanked him for his kindness, and we took leave of each other. As I traveled homeward, I reflected on the 12 pills which had to be consumed before light would return to my blinded eye. And now it had. 43. The young priest appears. Several years went by in which my husband and I lived pleasantly and happily, our love for each other unchanged. I continued my work as a sculptress, with lots of assignments, and in my free time more and more people came to me for psychological consultations. Several times a week I gave lectures on self-recognition and understanding, based on the secret knowledge Tahotep had given me in Egypt. And whenever I felt like resting from my exertions, there was always my beloved piano. Every day I practiced spiritual yoga and even attained the ability to go into deep trances, but the last, highest door on my pathway remained closed and locked before me. Having attained a certain degree of spiritual development, I found the pathway towards the complete realization of myself was blocked by an obstacle like a wall I couldn't break through with my consciousness. Every year one spent several months living alone in our forest lodge and practicing yoga. The young fruit trees I had planted years before were now big, strong, well-developed trees, and still I practiced with unabated diligence, yet the guardians of the secret gateway refused me admission. It was autumn once again, and I left our little house in the forest to spend a day in the city celebrating my father's 70th birthday with the whole family, our relatives and our many friends. The following morning, as I was preparing to start the trip back to the forest lodge, our telephone rang. An elderly friend asked me what I was doing that afternoon. I told her I was free. The famous writer with whom I studied in India under Maharishi has arrived and is staying at my house. If you're interested, come around this afternoon and you can talk with him, my friend said. That afternoon I rang my friend's front door bell. Stepping into the parlor, I caught my first glimpse of the man who had attained world renown through his books about yoga and the great yogis in India. At my first glimpse, I was taken aback. There, in front of me, sat the young priest who had helped me with my last preparations for my initiation in my long-ago life in Egypt. We exchanged a few comments in which I mentioned that I had read his books and that I had been practicing yoga for a long time but still was unable to reach the highest goal. Other guests dropped in and we were all soon involved in a general conversation which lasted far into the evening. There was no further opportunity to talk with him alone. In leaving I thought, so nothing happened. Secretly I had hoped the famous white yogi would help me ahead on my mystic pathway. The next morning my friend rang me up again to tell me the writer wanted to speak to me alone. "If you have time, come around again this afternoon," she invited me. Entering her parlor I found the famous writer sitting in the lotus posture on the sofa. As I too sat down he asked me, "What do you wish of me?" "I have no wishes," I replied. "I'm living quite contentedly in absolute inner peace." "Then why have you come to me? What do you expect of me?" "I want reality," I said. After a moment's silence the writer looked at me and asked, "And your absolute inner peace, isn't that reality?" "Yes, indeed, it is reality. But I'm looking for more. I feel like a Moses who saw the promised land but never got there. I believe I can see it too. But I'd like to get in. I'm not satisfied just seeing it from the outside and seeing what's inside. I want to get in myself." He smiled. "Yes," he said, "you're standing high front of the great door with your hand already on the doorknob. It's extremely rare that anyone can progress up to the point you've reached all alone and without the help of a master. You have probably been initiated in some previous life, and now you only need to make the last step through the gate that separates you from the great goal." I looked at the yogi. Doesn't he remember he was a priest in ancient Egypt and knew me there? Question mark, I thought. Or is it just that he would prefer not to talk about it? From his impenetrable gaze I couldn't tell. "I know that already," I answered, "and I want to get through the door even if I have to break it down with my fist." "And do you believe I can help you?" he asked. "If I am ready for it, yes, you can certainly help me. And if you're ready for it, you believe I can help you?" he asked again. "Yes," I answered firmly. Then, as if waiting for this reply, he pointed to the chair opposite from where he was sitting and said, "Sit down over there, close your eyes and think yourself intently into your heart." I did as he said, closed my eyes and concentrated intently on my heart. Then with my eyes closed, I saw a strong yellow current of bright light flowing out of the yogi's solar plexus, encompassing me like a circle, then encircling him again like a big figure eight. Simultaneously I felt I was coming in my concentration to the point I had so often been able to attain in the past without being able to go forward. And now I felt a great power, foreign to myself, reaching into my consciousness and carrying me forward, as if through a door, into an infinite depth beyond. Every concept of time disappeared, and I hadn't the faintest idea how much time had passed when I heard the voice of the white yogi again, "Now you may open your eyes." In doing so, I realized how far away I had been from earthly physical consciousness. I didn't feel like talking because it seemed superfluous to say anything at all. "I have set up a contact between your personal self and the overself," the writer said, "because you're ready for it. From now on, whenever you have a question, concentrate on me, and you'll get your answer the same day. On your person or on the higher self?" He smiled and said nothing. I understood perfectly. It was completely useless to waste a single word talking about the person. From that day on I found myself one of a group of people meeting at my friend's house and meditating under the leadership of the yogi. A few weeks later he left us to continue his travels. Once again I was alone and found myself living outwardly just as I had before. About a half a year later I was sitting with a number of friends, listening to one of the group talking about black magic. He said black magicians chose a few disciples whom they use as blind tools to carry out their will without resistance. These disciples are possessed by the black magician, lose their independence completely, and are finally destroyed. The next morning as I remembered these words, I began to wonder whether I had been lacking in caution in my meeting with the famous white yogi. I was still convinced that he was a white magician if we wanted to call him anything, but I had nevertheless put myself completely in his hands with a blissfully innocent trust. Was he after all a black magician question mark or really a white one? How can I know? How can anyone know whether he's dealing with a white or with a black magician? This question really bothered me. That afternoon we were visiting one of my husband's old school friends. While we were chatting, he told us how that very day he had been leafing through the pages of an old book, and how in doing so he had come across a highly interesting chapter about the difference between white and black magicians. The white magician, when he wants to help one of his pupils onward, binds the pupil to himself in the form of an eight. His full independence, because both teacher and pupil form the midpoints, each of his own individual circle. On the contrary, the black magician takes away his pupil's independence by taking him into a circle with himself in such a way that the black magician is in the center of the circle and the pupil just inside the circumference, in the same way a satellite's orbit forms a ring around the sun. I listened to this story with the keenest excitement. Our friend didn't have the vaguest idea he was giving me an answer I was seeking. I had not mentioned the matter to anyone. And yet I got my answer the very day my question came up. The higher self, God, always finds a human mouth when he has a message for us. For the self there is no such thing as an obstacle. 44 Ima and Boga then the great war game. Both of the men who belonged to me put on uniforms. My husband was mobilized for service in one of the largest government industrial plants to come under military control. He had to carry the heavy responsibilities of a commander. One day we were sitting together at table. The door opened and in walked our son, in an Air Force uniform. I felt as if the earth had disappeared beneath our feet and I were falling into an abyss. Within our circle of friends, every one of the fine young men who had gone into the Air Force had very soon after been carried into the cemetery. Strangely enough, the moment he walked in wearing his Air Force uniform, I had the odd feeling I had already seen him in such a uniform. But there was no time to puzzle over when and where I could have seen him. I was simply horrified at the thought he had gone into the Air Force. The countries we were fighting against had much better aircraft than ours. They had shot down our very best boys, for only the very best were able to pass the exacting physical and mental entrance exams, like so many toy balloons. At the very moment I was working on a big composition for a tombstone for a young flyer killed in action, one of my son's boyhood chums. And there I was looking at my very own son in an Air Force uniform. "How did you come by this uniform?" I asked him. "Government issue," he answered proudly. "I've passed the entrance exams for the Air Force. We thought we'd arranged for you to get into the Engineers Corps. How come you're in the Air Force now? No young man can get into the Air Force without his parents' consent. Mother, with the war on, they've done away with the requirement of parental consent, as you can see for yourself." I was speechless. There was nothing I could do. And there came days when I wandered around in our apartment like a sleepwalker, talking to God. My power over my child was at an end. I had to turn him over to God, and I did so consciously. I was forced to realize that God loves my son more, must love him more for the simple reason that he is God, than I, an imperfect human being, have it in my power to love him. No matter what might happen, I told myself, it was certainly for the best, even if it might seem like a catastrophe to me in my human short-sightedness. I was forced to act on the strength of my faith in the reality of God. I couldn't allow my heart to tremble, and I had to control my nerves with absolute calm, because I was forced to consider the fate of my one and only child from the standpoint of the great divine plan, beyond time and space, instead from my little human standpoint. And considering it this way, I was also forced to act accordingly. Other mothers were praying day and night for their sons. How could I have done that? God doesn't allow himself to be persuaded by humans, and according to the law of character and destiny, I knew that whatever happened to my son, no matter what, was certain to be the very best experience for the development of his consciousness. Yes, God loves him. Even more than I do. This realization gave me the strength to go on living. As the war dragged on, life became a kind of uninterrupted waiting for the end of this mass murder. Outwardly, things went on pretty much as they had before. We worked, and we went to concerts, operas, theatrical performances and to social gatherings among our friends, but all of this seemed to flow past us, for at the back of all these external events in our lives, there was always the same incessant waiting. Waiting for the end of the war. A few years went by in this way, and with increasing clarity I could see with my inward eye the gigantic military steamroller closing in on us from the east. One day a friend rang me up to say she wanted to introduce me to a very interesting person. He was an Indian, a genuine yogi, she added. Often before that she had wanted to introduce me to genuine yogis, but I had always found them out very quickly to be perfectly ordinary and average people. Despite all these experiences, she continued to act as if she were convinced that every Indian must somehow be a very highly developed yogi. reason enough why I wasn't exactly excited about her new discovery. Refusing to take no for an answer, she insisted on coming to see me.